That's right.
What was his voice?
The man, Eustace Man, Mr. Wayne Blake Jones.
Well, when did you come to Alaska?
1922.
What did you do in Rome before you came to Alaska?
Oh, I know. I had my hand in a couple of things. I was guiding, hunting with fishing paddles on the gap. Mm-hmm. Principally, I was a white water man for the lumber companies. I came down the Yukon in the canoe that fall and landed at Circle. That was a wild and lonely place. Not then. There weren't many people there, but it was very remote. When we walked from there across the Fairbanks, well, that was up the road. They had the road as far as Chattanooga. That was a steep highway. They were working on the moose. A few years ago, we used to be terrible, although I think there were hundreds of thousands of them everywhere. But the world didn't bear the moose so much. They'd been mostly on caribou. But it's been born in our New Year's observation that the wolves kill a ratio of 5 cows to 1 bull. That's why I hate these cow moose season of the hunters. Because the wolves take care of any other population that might be on cows. The cows have hard going in the beginning in February. They're heavy with calf at times. Easy prey for wolves. Then during the summer and the beginning of the fall, they have their calves with them. And they'll stop and fight for the calves, and they will get them. The bear, the black bear, they're vicious too. They take a terrific toll on the calf crops in the summer. And in fact, the one moose pasture that I find over about 3 times a week with the male. And I had a preacher with me that could verify this, or, you know, I'm telling the truth. There were 3 bears in the meadow. They had 5 cow moose corralled, living on that meadow. The cows hadn't had their calves yet, but they were about to have them. And the bears were laying for the calves, and then cow moose didn't run the meadow. The bears were laying. So we went down and we chased one bear out of the meadow, a big one. Took a couple of good buzzers and combed his hair real good to get him out of the meadow. And while I was chasing another one to get him out of the meadow, the other one came back. So it was a losing game. The preacher got sick and so we went 5 miles an hour over across the river in another big meadow, and there's 2 bears over there had 2 cows corralled and held them right there. And they held them right there for 2 days too because I watched them. Now, that's what's going on in the woods all the time with your game. Every day, 24 hours a day. Wolves, I know that 6 wolves will take the biggest bull moose in his tightness trim at the best time of the year for him to fight, and 6 wolves will take him. And I've got a hunch that 3 will take him, too. Maybe 2. But 3, I think, will do it. But I know it's 6 wolves. You'll see it done. I circled around overhead and watched them kill moose. And caribou was fine, too.
When did you join the Alaska Game Commission?
27th, March,
27th. You started flying from
here in Alaska? Yeah, I started flying in 29. And I started doing 28, but I didn't get going until 29.
I remember you telling me that the moose were all over New York. That's the first time I ever heard of moose being off the way down to the
coast. Yeah. There's always been moose up there, I guess. It's not like I found out from Eskimos. There's been a few moose on the Colorado River and on them tributary creeks like the Valley of the Willow, the Picnic, and the Willow Creek over there, near the Canning. All of them little valleys that had willows and alders in them, usually had 1 or 2 moose hanging around, and in some instances, take a time. The best concentration was between the mouth of Killick on the Colorado and the mouth of Anacortes. There were quite a few moose in there. But the Navy just went from bail about every 4 or 5 years, and I guess when they went in there, they just about cleaned them out, because there was no place for Moose to hide, there was no place for him to go. The Willow was the tallest Willow, he was, the Moose would be as tall as the Willow was, and all he could be was seen. And there wasn't much food to take on the Willow. In 55, I was up there all summer long, flying the coast today. And there was quite a lot of Moose there. And I saw them out in the tundra, feeding out on lakes. And they were at least 15, 20 miles from the nearest willow bush, which was good to be no more than knee high anyway when you did get to them. Where they stayed, I don't know, because you go there a dozen times, you wouldn't see them, but it's feeding time, and see them out in the lakes. They must have been hiding somewhere. And speaking about feeling going north, when I come out that fall, the weather was kind of bad, and I was kind of tripping the thunder a little bit. An upland coming through Santa Cruz Pass, big boy. He didn't turn around, did he? He turned around up and down there, went right over and down through the pass, and kept that on going down there. Down here on the field.
What is it,
good
game that way? Pressure,
wrist
pressure?
It could be wrist pressure, yeah. The waves at that time were awful thick on the fire hook, and they are, yeah, too. There's too many of that. There's lots of waves over there. It's a heavy wrist population. And, the last 4 years has been a terrific increase in the bear population over there. Usually, what you see flying across the country in the line of bears, black bears, you see the size of two cubs. Ooh, what the hell, you see them in three? That's normal. You don't see very many of them in three. But the last 3 or 4 years of flying up there on the main runs, there was a lot of tongues in the there that had four cubs. You were scaring the bear, you could just see the bears increase. Next year, it'd be twice as many bears as one year before. And you get to that one 50 of the recent days into everything, and you get 31 to 30 of anybody. They're hungry. And when you land on the old field at Hog River, that was a big field. And we, I'd have a load of meat, maybe. And it'd take them 20 minutes sometimes to get from the camp out there with a truck. Well, I didn't even dare open the door of the airplane, and bears were just sitting all around the airplane, storing that meat. Then I'm going to buy the sugar one day and get out in the middle of the field and he's eating it. And I was trying to land, and they couldn't drive him away from there. So they finally had to shoot him and drag him off the field and go out and land. Oh, they're nuisance. There's too many of them anyway. And just as a sidelight on that, back in Maine, they had a bounty on bears there for I don't know how many. When I was old enough to know anything about it, I knew there was a bounty on bears because I used to collect it every now and then. I used to go out and deal with bears. And they took that bounty off about 10 years ago, but they didn't put no protection on them. Now they got the many bears up there, they don't know what to do with them. Back in Maine, where they got population. They don't know what to do about those bears. They don't like to kill them off, there's no protection, whatever. No bounty, but there's no license required to shoot them, there's no limit on them, and there's no seed. You see them coming out of them. And they still got the money. So I don't see any real need of protecting black bears. If they're going to have too many of them, whatever you do. You've had all out war, and you're still going to have a big bear population, especially with something like this.
How are the grizzlies
not arranged
there?
I wonder
how
it is. Is there any feedback? No, I've never seen any great increase in the grizzly bear. You find the few here and there in the grizzly bear country. Over on the north slope there, probably a few more bears there than there is in most places now, and over in them British mountains over there where they put in the wildlife refuge. That's quite a busy country over there. The grizzly bears don't get picked like black bears, you know, because I guess it's takes too much country to support one of them. They eat a tremendous amount of food when they eat. I guess in a lot of days they don't eat, but when they get down to it, they put away a lot of grub.
Tell me, in that refuge,
that
the
polar bears
came in to
do refuge in Southwest. Well, I never seen a polar bear in there, but I don't know why they wouldn't go in there, because they'd fly down to the coast there, you know. Yeah, they'd be very likely polar bears to go in there, all right. I've seen polar bears over at Cockadoo, 60 miles inland, you know. Not very often, but it was always. And up at Wainwright, too.
They don't think any of the bear populations
in danger. Well, I don't know. The grizzly bear, that's a different thing, you know. They're getting to work pretty hard on them, really. You know, we used to drive near the ground east and see several bears. Well, the last few cold that day, down there, I didn't see any bears. Grizzlies. And outside the hunters were taking a hold of them, you know. This is about the only place in the summer I've had a most Columbia now, where the river's at.
If I didn't
know,
how did the deer get along in northern Maine, you know?
Yeah, they have their ups and downs. They get into the deep snow and big population of deer and come and die from starving. But they come back very quickly, though. Yeah, awful. 6 feet and two in common, in places.
Well, how cool is it that they go here?
No, it's not their country. No, it gets down to 50 below that cold, and not a factor, I don't think, so much as back there, wherever you see deer, is cedar, especially when they're feed, see? Cedar? We buy from cedar trees, you know. And there's no doubt that things up here that they could subsist on the road going up here. They wouldn't last on them. Too helpless and small.
Yeah,
I think that's fine for me. I've been there 2.4 years. And then
after that, I was on my own.
You were based? No, I wasn't based anywhere when I was flying on my own. I was flying government contract mostly, but I did fly down the river in the wintertime. Trappers flew by over. I found out flying trappers was a pretty rough game.
Do you think the game has any about the future, the game in
the last year, that they're going to have any, you know, do you keep on reducing the numbers, or do you go up to the future? No, I don't think you'll ever see a big herd of caribou ever again. Well, this one's in the pod, you know. You remember years ago, I got on the up trees little road we had then. And the caribou would start to cross, and for an hour or two, you'd have to stop and wait. The caribou wouldn't pay any attention to you. They'd fall all around your car, they'd make your windshield, throw in gravel on it. And now, they tell me, what's the caribou put over here, and they see a couple of cars, and they take off right back where they come from again. Well, the railroads and the highways and these high-powered cars and motorboats and airplanes are just too much for them, that's all.
Can't
take up. Well, I take it that's one of the last big resources.
Keep it going
as possible again. That's right. Yeah, I think history is repeating itself right up here. We all know the pattern. Everybody knows the pattern. We've got your responsible hunters, we've got good hunters, we've got good sportsmen. But amongst them is a whole bunch of irresponsible guys, and you take a bunch of them that are real good guys and real responsible guys in around town, you know. They get a gun in their hand and a pocket full of ammunition and get them out there, and then there'd be bunches of caribou, and they're just wild.
Well,
They do things that you don't know what makes them do it. Can't figure it out. And the only way you can stop that would be to have a game warden go with each one of them if they're subscribed to that disease. I don't think we'll ever see one big hundred cowboy ever again.
Well, there should be more effort.
Yeah, I think that well, the wolves get sick like they do up in the trap up there. They get out of hand, and they just clean up everything. I think they should be kept down. I've been seeing them up there in flocks of 40 and 50, you know. Nothing to see a band of 20 odd wolves. And right there at Hughes, in the carpet there, the headquarters of the wolves is Indian Mountain. And they start out from Indian Mountain, they cross the carpet at the north end of Indian Mountain, they go into Hog River, then they go down into the flats, and there's a big moose pasture down in there, and they're very warm, and they cross through that, and they cross the carpet again about 50 miles, 40 miles, below in the mountain, south in the mountain, they make that big circle and went back into the mountain. And they do that about every 2 weeks. Big band of them. And if you ever see anything wicked, you want to see a bunch of wolves killing a moose or a cowboy, a moose festival, and take one of them killing a moose. They just tie all the pieces and eat them while the moose is still wandering around and fighting, you know. And many of them, they go all their lives. They take what they want out of them, eat a few of them hungry anyway. They kill them for fun, you know, and they eat a little bit. Eat a big hole in them and go on with my eye. And I see some of them live for 48 hours, checked on them. I see places and bump off and see them myself. I don't know, I just didn't want to see them suffering. And the places I put my eye on, I keep watching them. They live 24, 40 hours, die a little later. But they tear a great big junk right off on them, you know, and I saw, well, it turned out to be 14 wolves killing a big old cow that had already killed a calf. And I saw them when they dumped the cow, she was fighting back because she thought that her calf might be still alive, I guess. She'd make no attempt to get away. And they just tore off great big strips of hide and just threw them out onto the snow. And afternoon, you could see their back bones going like that when they were wrenching on them hide, on the strips of hide. You know. I took them 10 minutes to kill our old cow. And they didn't eat her after they killed her. They left her there. I don't know, pieces. Now, then there is a very sad end. I got dinner hungry and sitting there and sitting over there. And the wolves were all on top of the old cow, and I didn't get a chance to count them because they were all piled up, you know. I went over there the next morning, and it was 14 wolves. I got the whole bunch. It was off in a big open jack spruce flat, you know, just a jack spruce in there. And I went over the next day after they got on, and I said, oh, boy, look at that, and they're going to battle for a pool of blood, all over the storm, all down, you know. Really looked wicked. But they got over on their wolves. There was always a pair of hunters, you know, that I should have kept them in business. They went into the state or somebody should have kept them out in business. They couldn't keep themselves in business. But that guy Stickman, he could fly under trees and around trees and land on the top of the mountain. And Huntington, he didn't need a shotgun. All he needed was a rifle. He didn't miss anything. And he got after a wolf didn't get away from him. But they had no business around it, you know. They were both on neighbors. Yeah. I've never heard of an authentic case of it in this country yet. You know what happened. but I tell you when it will happen, is when the game gets scarce, getting scarce, then is when it'll happen, but we're going to eat. I know the very follow people are. I know they treat Donald, one or two of them treat Donald McDonald up, putting up a tree over there at North Central one time, sitting there an hour or so. I've had them follow me. They're pretty funny about it. They keep out of sight, but you know they're following you, what's the problem? But you don't see them. I came down the Shangri-La one time from Little Squaw Lake in March with a very heavy snowfall, a breaking trail. Came to a place where the boys had crossed the Shangri-La. It's pretty wide down the roundabout, and going in one direction only. And there the trail was lagging with the table, and it was just as smooth. It must have been 75 wheels crossed there, just going one way, and they just crossed there. And the bags got up within 50 feet of that trail, and they laid down, they didn't go across it. You know that. I had to go and walk across, and then drag the bags across there, and that time of the line, two in total at bay. And you can see the hills, you can see the hills and up all the time during daylight hours up on the side of the hill with caribou all over everything, you know, and we were sitting there waiting until they got hungry, the caribou was feeding all around them, and then they kept just about 100 yards from them all the time. The wolf moved, by the caribou moved, they were away from them. I've caught two nights between Little Squaw and Shangri-La Lake Village. And I had to build a fence around the dog that night. We were coming out in the camp. Just sort of get back. They were right in there, a whole bunch of them. But they didn't come behind the best fence. And the dog didn't eat. The dog was sitting inside there when I went to Shangri-La Lake Village. I was on the sled, keeping the bag right away.
Well,
they
eat the dog,
though. Oh, they love dog meat. Yeah, I wouldn't the dog ever come to Alaska. It could handle a wolf. No, there wasn't one ever come up to him. It was worth the killing. Just in one quick snap like that. You take them off the chain, too. Yeah, that's happened right here, but and it couldn't even be called halfway successful. The wolf is not made to work. They're not built to work. They got no chest on them, and legs and long and limber. They need for speed. And that disposition they got, they ain't going to work out of a disposition like that. The only thing left they can only get you to see the pants and make two of them. That's the best chance they get.
What's the biggest wolf you've ever seen, Sam?
Gosh, I seen some awful big ones. I think it'll be 50 pounds. I really don't know. I shot 5'2". I get up quite a few that you like out of shooting them. And they're so cruel and sad, you know, but of course I don't like them looking in the face when they're after I wound them. I wound them out. They got an awful pair of eyes to look at. Oh, okay. water down here in the plant fishery too, some of them, you know, bunking down there. But I haven't seen any of them, wouldn't have heard, you know, for quite a number of years, because I hadn't been in that particular part of the country when the caribou were there. But they used to be quite common, you know, pretty much all through the interior. You've been in there every now and then. Now, what we see them mostly around, when we see them around here, it's a little Arctic, barren ground caribou. Yeah, there's a pretty fair-sized herd on the Arctic slope in the summer. And they come on down into the summer step there, some of them come on down through the mountains to the Kobuk and the Norpak. And for 6 or 8 years, for about 8 years, we wasn't a caribou seen on the caribou, except right up to their head in the mountains. But, years ago last fall, they started coming back, and the whole bunch of them came in through the hills there, over the, well, we didn't look at it a second time from what we'd seen in the old days, you know, because it was only a small fraction. But they came back there in their own hills. There used to be a bunch of, wintered down here in Pigeon Tamina, right back along the hot springs there and there. There used to be about 1,500 winter there. And then they've all gone, and they've gone for years, I haven't seen any in there. Then the Malaysia and the Tango, there was lots of caribou wintered in there. But they're not there, they don't see any of them there. It may be that they would come through from the Quebec and the Norpac. A few years ago, they may spread out and populate that country again. But never like it was where we used to see it. So I remember the big herd that went through there and big giant rapids.
Yeah, it was
a whole mountain. Several mountains went along and around. The ground was alive and they didn't destroy all the feet. They ate their feet and kept on going. They were moving, you know. They were a lot of caribou feet. You could see trails that looked like a farmer had been up that pine, and that even then the trails in between, there was tracks all right, but there was a whole lot of caribou feet left there yet. But the railroad and the highway and the farms and make up the migration route, and the caribou breeding instinct is tied directly into his migration. And when he stops migrating, he stops breeding. We found that out down in Minnesota. We found it out in Maine, too. They used to have the big herd of caribou in Minnesota, you find. The last caribou was seen in Maine in 1901. We had a big herd out there. And here, 15, 20 years ago, a hunter up in the Red Lake District in Minnesota, he shot a fruit deer. And he was very proud of it. He buried it in the bottom of the bottom, and he had to go in there and look at it, and he was terrible. He went up there and they found 12 caribou isolated. And they were dying off. They were very young ones. They weren't breeding because they weren't migrating. They tried to save them. They found 12 townships there, empty townships, those caribou. Didn't save them though. So that's what you got here now. They're making up their migrations. Their migrations are changing. You've seen caribou go right through the town for a while in the migration. I've seen them go across the field and tie up that plane traffic an hour or two or more. But you don't see that anymore. And he had a big data. He would sometimes was whispering away and he was just alive on both sides of the road. You don't see that anymore.
The reindeer
herds
have gone into the caribou
herds. Yeah. Well, you see caribou, you see reindeer strains amongst all of the caribou herds in the last 1 hour. And that wasn't good for the caribou either, you know. Because the cows had a caribou picked up a lot of diseases from the reindeer. The reindeer was a semi-domesticated caribou to begin with, you see. And during that semi-domestication, he fell off of diseases that he didn't fall off here in the wild. When they died over here, they were Here from now on. and radio was very poor. And I heard a radio station trying to get over a message that I couldn't pick it up. And he was trying to get the message, and Mrs. James, maybe after the event, he's very good about picking things out of the air. And she had a hard time to get this. Well, I just shut the radio off and put Duncan to the fire, and I figured she'd have it when I got there. It was an emergency, all right, but couldn't tell where it was, or what it was. Well, look here, and it found out that what she had got fragments of the message over there, and what she had put together there, says, man half gone, need medical aid, send Sam. And I was a new one, I knew, and I didn't know anybody could get half ground. I thought we were down, we weren't ground, but anyway, emergency. Went in some gas, and I took off to this village. Took about an hour to get there. I landed, they brought this young Indian out in a sleeping bag. I even had to have a sleeping bag in the airplane. There were moose grease and bear fat in it and candle dripping. Well, I think that he was horizontally vertical, and they couldn't get back, but there was one Indian up there, so I needed to let him have to lay down. Okay. So I got out, I took out the seat, laid him down on the plane, you know, and I was trying to figure out what a half man, half down man ought to look like. It didn't look like he'd half down, but there was something wrong with him. So I took the map over there, the one that he had to lie down. You get on there now and you go to town on him and take care of this guy over there. Nope. He jumped in. Then about an hour and 15 minutes, he was at town on there, and when I got within radio distance, I was calling and I heard the doctor there, and he and the nurse were down to the field of the ambulance. And I didn't know anything about this patient yet. I didn't know what to come here. He was never knew. So I had the ball, and the doctor stuck his head in there, and he said, can he walk? Well, I didn't know. I looked at him. And I said, no. And he says, his leg's hurt. That's why he can't walk. His leg's hurt. No. Well, then he can walk to the ambulance. And I said, bring that in the pants. So they put him on the stretcher, and led him into the ambulance. He was not bothered now, you know. So the doctor says to me, he says, put it on, Hals, we're going to go back to his lungs. And send him back to you, maybe. And I was turning up there, they went to pass for a terminal, turning around, having a cup of coffee, and visiting with some friends, and telephone rang, and the doctor says, tell him to go home. He says, this fellow shot in the hip with a gunshot. I got to keep him there. But they won't tell him anybody. Oh, I started in with that Golden Eagle and I wound up right next to the Swallow biplane. And I graduated to the Stimsons and the Curtis Wagons and the Thrushes and the Blankers, Fairchild 71s and 24s, and there was a few others, Children's. Blanker. CH-400. Best big plane I've ever made.
Land and take off on quite a short
piece, wasn't it? Well, they had performance, yeah. I mean, they were easy to drive around on the ground, you know, either bottom way you wanted to. Turn around, again, great performance. They, every part of the airplane was an airfoil, you know. The fuselage was an airfoil, it packed its own weight. And the struts packed their weight. They were an airfoil. That left the wing to carry the load. They were slow and very precise. Just as accurate as shooting a gun, yeah. They knew. And you could land in the same track all day long and just as many times you wanted to.
Did they have enough power?
Yeah, they had plenty of power. Yeah, that was the senior pacemaker. That leaves the cattle up in the CH-400, too. They leave the payload in about, probably 900 pounds. Well, them contract, them survey contracts, they were the model of the most interesting plan I ever did. And I put in a good many years of that, both with the geological and the geodetics, and then the Army Air Corps geodetics. But in the other time I did some ski work for the geodetics, the Army geodetics. The map of Alaska didn't exist up until about 10 years ago. There hadn't been hardly a skeleton of a map of Alaska. You had a map, all right, but you try to go to some place on it and use it for what a map is supposed to be, and you'd wind up anywhere from 16 to 35 miles out away from the place you want to go to. And now you're closer to the map was. Some place is closer. Well, when the Army come up here during the war, World War II, they were leaving planes all over that. We knew about that. The pilots at last, they were used to radio waves, you know. They had a different system of navigation than we had up here. And they couldn't do that because we hadn't radio waves here enough time. And that Bowman's flying, they didn't understand that at all. And they didn't know the damage of anyway. So they were getting off all over, and they had a crash program to straighten out the map of Alaska so they could navigate. And what they did, they had to shoot the stars, you see. And in the summertime up here, you can't shoot the stars, so that was a wintertime job. And they had to come up there, and they had a big map of Alaska with them, and all these places named on it, like Cairo and Zenitai and a bunch of other places, and they were in here. Hotels there. So when they asked me how about the accommodations of this hotel, that hotel up on Black River, I went in with a traffic cabin, and there was no accommodation to that hotel. Well, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to sleep in the tent. Oh, not me. No. That tent up there, part of the world, I know. But they did. You know that? And it's pretty comfortable in tents, you know. You get the 8 to 10 wall tent, close over, Yukon stove, and they couldn't work. Theoretically, they could work down to 40 below. But actually, when it panned out 33 below, they could work their instruments in because the mercury would chew up into a little ball, you know. They had a pool of mercury, the stars committee. Well, then the only way they had these points marked on the map where they wanted these star shots. And there were no names. It was all so top secret business. There was no names there, and they had numbers. And the numbers were wrong in nearly all instances. And you look on the map, and the numbers were wrong mixed up, you know. But all I would do that, and I would have to know which place we'd gone to because I'd been to that night before. And I could recognize them in the picture. They had pictures taken from 20,000 feet. And I could recognize those lakes. And they wouldn't believe me. And they were running away over to Canada. No, that ain't the lake. That ain't the lake. It's far east. Well, I'd try to. I could use that gasoline and not go away and get back here. So I'd climb over to where the Canadian line went off through the Pinto. I said, you're going to be bigger than in Canada? No, you don't want to go to Canada. And I said, there's the Canadian line right there. You know, I said, let's turn back and go where I want to go. So you get out and get on that lake. Now, look around here. See if you can make that picture fit this lake. That's why I decided maybe it's good. So they'd set up their instruments and stars would come right in. And the minute they then they knew it was a lake. But we went to Shelly Lake up in the Arctic there, and that was a different thing. I experienced so well. There was no wood up there, nothing. And that lake was 35 miles out east and west and 16 miles out north and south. And I told him about that. They were making up the stylist and butter. And I said, we don't want to make up the stylist. That way, I said, it's in the map. I said, that's no good. He's got 35 miles out east and west and 15 miles out north and south. But they made up the stylist anyway, and the next day we went up there. And we had a briefing day and a briefing night that night. And we could have got down. But they never got one star into the pool at all. And so the next morning there was a howling blizzard like you never had before in your life, and you stick your head out of the tent, and you're like sticking it in a bowl of milk. And you sat there for 14 days. No doubt, I gave them in firm position. And there they were. And then they got the star left from that position, and the next, when the big day came, and the star rolled right into the pool right in a minute. And that got it. From then on, they didn't question me at all.
And when did that
baby start up in the middle of the field?
After
World War II. Somewhere in there.
They got a, they call us a unit,
have a
unit,
special
tribe. Where did
that unit
come from?
Them are the nomads.
Sure.
They were the first time I was in, and first people in 1927. And I got acquainted with old Elijah Katrina there. I got acquainted with most of them. They couldn't talk any English in those days, you know. But old Elijah Katrina, he's known back now that he was young back then. And he was blocked and he was afraid, and he was wild as a caribou. But he never took each other, you know. And they had the, they come down at Fort Yukon, down to Fijik. They pushed the camps a mile out of town, and they wouldn't fraternize the natives or white men either. And they had, they had about 20 dogs per person now. It was a big thing for them. And they pitched the dogs in the room right around the camp so nobody could get in there. Boy, you couldn't get by them dogs. They'd take a leg right off of that. Even the Indians couldn't get there. They didn't stop in our car. They stayed there 2 weeks to 65 below. They were living in skin tents. Even on the stoves, they were in the rock luxury because they had wood to burn. They never seen nothing like that before, you know. They weren't suffering no hardships at all in the skin tents. All they did, and they didn't need them for them. They had 200 white fox skins with them. And that was the year 30 of King, you know, 27, 28. And the traders, they tried to buy them foxskins, they didn't sell them. And when they got ready to go, back to the Arctic, Elijah, he comes up me, and the sign language, why, maybe I'll find him out, he went to the NC store, and he swapped two foxskins for ammunition, tobacco, and tea. That's all he wanted, meat for the rest of it. He had meat passed all along the way, and he went back to the Arctic. So now, every time I go down a few paths, I can't stop. I have a ceremonial dinner with Elijah in his life. Huh? Oh, it's part of them. Not like the Yukon ones.
But he's
riding before the two, so he has ivory though. I didn't know I had that. I didn't look on the bottom of my head. And Elijah, he's quite a guy, you know. He's a really reliable sort of a fellow. You know him, I guess, don't you?
Not really.
Yeah, well, she's the slimmest, longest, leanest Eskimo woman I ever see. And when we have a, when Elijah and I have a banquet, why, it's fried caribou meat and pepper and salt and tea. That's what it is. The old lady, she stands over the Yukon stove and wonders at a program now, you know. And she fried the caribou meat, and she's got a long cigarette holder, and a cigarette sticking way out here, and the ashes dropping in the pan. It's good. The atmosphere, you know. And then Elijah, he gets out his, he's got a roll of greasy paper there, a brown paper tied up the stove. And one way that, when that, he's got pictures he's taken in 1927 or so people, him and I, and the camp. And we have to look at them again.
Where did they live originally
from? They lived there, well, they came originally from the coast, you know, but they went back inland there to get away from the influx of white people, half a dozen traders around, so. And then Foxkins, the reason they didn't want to sell that money, they didn't know what money was, and they didn't want any money. If they had $10 bills, they'd probably be like a fire with it, you know, so they must have killed them. they could trade them for cow or for rice or toast or potatoes or whatever, not cow or whatever. And that's the only thing they knew. They knew that they could they knew that they'd get certain things for fur, but they didn't know they could get that same thing for money.
Oh, they caught it,
the Indians. No, they shot it, the Indians, they said. Yes, no, I think so. I don't know, they're not after cow. But they're tougher than wire.
They're
They had that thing place we did. They lived all the way from the church to the hula hula. Back and forth, back to the game, they had to move because they didn't have nothing to eat but game, you know. And fish. When the game got shot, they only had to fish. Well, they could eat fish for a month, but then after a month, the fish got pretty tiresome to them. They were bitter back and forth, and when they got back out of game, that was fine. They didn't need nothing else. So in 42, I was trying to wait for the army party. And they were camped at the city of the lake, all over down the lake, about 5 miles. So I was camped, you couldn't see it, they were in the snowbanks. They were living in the snowbanks. There's no wood down there, it was too early. The whole gang of them had built about one little fire day. They had green willows tied up in little bundles and about that long. And there's nobody in the area but Eskimos to set their own fire. And they can do it. And they boil one kettle of water and make tea. And they live under the snowbanks. We came to the camp and went back up to the lake. Up there, I heard they put that tent in that company here for about 2 hours. And they hadn't seen no money. So 2 hours, there comes a big dog team, found in the Pontiac, Elijah the Senior, and David Pia. They had coffee made for them, and they started drinking coffee. And they were eating coffee. That's when I hope they read the dog for a long time now. But they had a lot of fur. So they asked me if I would take the fur in the Fairbanks farm when I went in, and it happened that I was going in for 2 days because I had some damage to the fur in the walkway. Close to it. So I was going in and I was coming back to the lake. Well, they took out what we thought was about $700 of fur. They weren't that much groceries. 1,100 pounds, what I can haul. And the army boy told me to haul it in for us for nothing, because I was in the chatter anyway, I wasn't really paying for it. So. But then I took that fur and flew in the sea. And Officer kept looking at it. And it was such good grade, they turned down the old $1,000 worth of fur there. Well, we thought there was only 700. They don't rub it there, you know, because there's no dust on one thing. Beautiful dust on. I got this garden that didn't come for that much, so I was trying to give him credit for this thing. So we went put this stuff on the books and we found that I already had a $500 credit there. And they didn't know about it. They'd send in a bunch of fur by Sig Reed, and they were going to shop them out too. But they send in a bunch of fur, they get back a load of God, so as they're concerned, that's it. The transaction is made. So, right there. So I got back, I took the bill and credit slip, and everything I could take them back to them, and I spent hours trying to explain to him. Didn't get it in time. I was the grub bag guy, and Fox Springs would turn him in, and they didn't want him anymore. He was trying to just take it.
Well, what made him settle right there down to his patent? Was that because the terrible goes through there?
You were into the past. Yeah. Caribou, 50-50, caribou would be into the past. Well, I tell you, you can't work in the places and measure the scars and the finger bones of those people, you know. You do scientific work to fair women all over the country. You gotta have them. You gotta have them nailed down somewhere you can hold them.
What they
burned
there between
the hula hula
and the chili?
What's that?
What did they burn for
fuel? Oh, willow, somebody, you get it? And sometimes they'd come to a little coal room and they'd take the coal feathers 5 pounds of coal out, put it in a little sack, you know. And with one little man of that coal about that big, they'd boil quite a coffee or a tea, you know. They had it. Oh, yeah, you're a liar up there. You know where I worked up in White Creek?
I wasn't right there,
though. You heard of it, yeah? Yeah. I put that name here. No, I didn't put the name on it, but I was a car that was good enough. I'll tell you. I want to tell you, I was very afraid of the wolves. And we had a lot of camp, and there was a lot of roof dropping down there, so I cut off and shit, but he stuck it in the roof, and I showed him this pillow, and he got their knees up and running. He didn't stay to see him out, he got out of there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So I rolled the roof up and right.
We've got about a minute left on the tape. Is there anything you want to say in closing remarks?
No, I can't think of anything more. I think I covered it pretty good.
Well,
I want to thank Tom for his kindness for coming down here and telling how much we enjoyed this. And we hope you'll come down and join us all again.
Well, I think I better thank you all for sitting here listening to me, too.
Yeah, but Sam, I feel we've only got half of it.
Yeah,
I'm going
to have to get him here again.
Well, you know, there's 23 years of that fire, and then we got about 1 month of it, I guess.
Yeah. That's just what I thought.
We have some coffee and cookies now.